All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really pleased to be here with you today because we've got an extremely important show, and it's all about a subject that's extremely important to humanity, to the emancipation of humanity, and that is the struggle against the oppression of women, including the ongoing struggle for the right to abortion as part of the right of women to be able to live in society as full human beings. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. Now, this is an excerpt from the DVD talk, BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And right now, we're going to hear an interview I did recently with Dr. Willie Parker, an abortion provider and one of the leading advocates for abortion rights.
Dr. Parker is an amazing, amazing cat. He's a doctor based in the South, was based in the South. He was in the movie Trapped, if you saw that movie. A lot of people got to know him and the importance of what he's doing, his work and everything else, right? And he's got a book out that is an incredibly important book. It's called Life's Work, okay? And it's basically where he tells the story of his life and what brought him from being a religious devotee. He's into religion, but the big thing in his life is making sure that women are not enslaved, that women do not live in the handmaid's tale. And critical to that is that women have the right to get an abortion.
All right. I recently read a book that when I saw the title of it, I had to get it. And it was because it's something that I've paid a lot of attention to over the last few decades. And in particular, this book was also written by a person that I really have followed what he's been doing and admired what he's been doing and think he's actually doing work that is absolutely necessary. I consider him actually a very courageous hero in the world today. His name is Dr. Willie Parker, and his book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away. You've said that actually, and I think this characterizes a lot of what you do, you said you want to make it so abortion occupies the moral high road in society, in the world today, and it's something that actually has not been done, but it's actually something that you've dedicated your life to doing. Let's talk about why.
Well, you know, I would like to make abortion be a non-issue morally. Abortion should be no more moral or immoral than a person taking care of their health, and in this case, women. Taking care of themselves means that they should have the right, that they are morally entitled to the right to make decisions about their health, their lives, and their body. If I say a moral high road, if we say that the opposition to abortion it can be found on the road of morality, then I think the right to have an abortion has to be placed on that same road by allowing people who are opposed to abortion to turn it into a moral issue with no counter-narrative or no alternative position on that. Is by default to make women taking care of themselves a moral issue, and more in particular to make it an immoral issue. And I think that has allowed policymakers and people who see the world a certain way to elevate their position to one superior over the interest of a woman that she should be allowed to have in herself.
Now, one of the things that happens in all this is, which is also something you speak to right away in your book, and I thought it was very interesting that you did, you start off the book with a statement that one rarely ever hears, that as an abortion provider, I'm doing God's work. And this kind of captures a lot about your life and your role in the world. It also captures a lot of what the terms of the battle are with these people who are the anties out there who actually do want to chain women back in the prehistoric times, who basically want to make it so that women's bodies are controlled by men. They don't have any moral or actual real control over their body, or nor should they have it. So you actually have argued this as you're an abortion provider doing God's work, and that's going right up against these other people who also argue that they are doing God's work.
Sure. What it does is two things. Number one, the reality that for me, the reason I do this work, to make public my religious beliefs and my understandings in the context of the work I do, it wasn't anything strategic or tactical. It was to speak the truth about from where I live my life and where I get my values from. They are rooted in my understanding of Christianity, which for me became a conscious decision to pursue when I was 15 years old. And in that I've for so long held my beliefs as personal and most relevant to me has been why I've been most uncomfortable putting them in the public domain. But to the degree that those of us who understand the morality of a woman making her own personal decisions, to the degree that it's religious for any of us, it has to be religious for all of us. And so for me, just as people who are opposed to abortion and related to their religious or God understanding, and then they say that it prompts them to oppose abortion from a place of religious judgment, I come at my understanding about what I'm supposed to do and feel for other human beings in the context of religious compassion. Compassion is also to be found in religion, and it is simply the notion that the greatest action you can take on behalf of another person is to help them in their time of need. So people who are opposed to abortion are entitled to their opinions and even their religious beliefs about them, and so am I. If I say I'm supportive of abortion and they say that they are against abortion, we're each entitled to believe that. My notion is that with each of us having opposite notions, the public conversation around the morality of abortion should be canceled out within religious understanding. And what we should be really left with is the person who has to make the decision about whether or not to have an abortion. They should be left with what their inner voice is telling them. If one sense of morality is personal and deeply spiritual and should govern you, then my position on abortion or the position of a person opposed to abortion should not be overbearing to a woman as she's having to make this decision.
Now, you've argued, and your training as a scientist and your actual involvement with science from the time when you were a teenager is actually really important in relation to all this, too. And it's actually, you've said that for you, not carrying out abortions and not living out the convictions you have would be a fate worse than death. Let's talk about that.
Well, what I mean by that is we all live from a place of what means most to us and being true to oneself. As a scientist and understanding and appreciating the world in an evidence and empirical-based way, the natural forces of life, the scientific, biologic realities of life, they are indifferent to what my beliefs are. You know, the sun comes up whether I believe in it or not. Gravity is a force that works whether you believe in it or not. So having that appreciation or an empirical appreciation for the world and reality sit side by side with my non-empiric appreciation for reality. And that is what we found in my spiritual understandings of things that are equally important to me, and they are deeply personal. Whereas the scientific realities aren't personal, they are there and we all stand equal before them. My religious beliefs are quite personal. And because they're personal and subjective, they may not work or be plausible or palatable for someone else. And so it's with that understanding that I hold both of my identities in an integrated way. And so it's because I understand that my beliefs are personal, I have to decide when I'm working and living in the world and interacting with other people, which frame of reference is going to be most relevant. The one when it comes to making decisions about policy, about how we are going to allocate resources, about what freedoms and liberties and restrictions we're going to make for people, those have to be related to the thing in our world and in our reality that's most objective. And the most objective things are empirically based decisions or conclusions that we reach via science. And as I say that, I repeat the words of Albert Einstein when he said that not all that matters can be counted, and not all that can be counted matters. I'm not making an argument to say that if it's not based solely in empirical understanding, that it's not important. What I am saying is the things that should govern how we make our decisions as we live in a community have to be based on the things that we all stand objective before. Religion is not one of those things, but science is.
Very important. And one of the things that you look at today, I mean, look, abortion rights, as I was reading your book and as I'm going through this and I'm thinking, abortion rights today is under an unprecedented attack. I mean, more so than ever before. And it's a battleground, and it's a very dangerous battleground for women on many different fronts. And you're in the middle of that. Let's talk about how you see that battleground.
Well, I see the ability to turn a biologic reality like the fact that 1 in 3 women in their lives will end a pregnancy. And the pregnancies that are in this country and around the world, the majority of them that are ended are ones that are unplanned and unwanted. But unplanned does not mean unwanted, because over half of unplanned pregnancies are continued. and the ones that are unwanted and unplanned are the ones that end up in abortion. So something that is that common and that is a part of the biologic reality of women cannot be placed in the realm of people's preferences or likes and dislikes. Women need to have access to abortion care because we know empirically, without question, that when abortion is legal, it is safe and accessible. And when it's illegal, it is unsafe and it is very dangerous. We now have people who have grabbed power who, because ideologically, they find abortion and the biological reality that women need to end pregnancies distasteful, means that those of us who understand the importance of abortion from a safety standpoint can't stand by and watch what we know will happen if people are allowed to, because of their ideologies, they're allowed to control the health and lives of people who don't share their ideology. So it is a battleground, for lack of a better metaphor, because on both sides of this issue, people who are deeply convinced of what they think about it are motivated to defend their position. But what also makes it a battleground is that the argument, or at least the issue, is often framed in the context of what I call a false equivalency. The pro-life, pro-choice narrative has lent itself very well to people oversimplifying what the abortion decision is. And it is not one simply of pro-life and pro-choice. As a person who provides abortions, I'm pro-life. I'm pro-life of the mother. And so within the context of being against abortion or supportive of abortion, there's an element of choice in both of those sides. If you are against abortion, you can choose not to have one. And if you find yourself needing an abortion, you can choose to have one. But the pro-life, pro-choice narrative lends itself unnecessarily to battle conflict, which makes the analogy of war a very apt one.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Willie Parker, and we're talking about his life's work. And his book is called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Now, Dr. Parker, you've also said, and some of the stuff that you're talking to leads right into this, it's like very few doctors today have abortion as a specialty, even though almost every doctor is trained in one way or another to handle abortions. What's the scene here? I mean, what is it that actually has created a situation where residents train to do abortions, but the vast majority of them don't end up doing them? And overall, there's been an extremely sharp decline, as I understand it, in the numbers of abortion providers out in the world today.
Well, there certainly would have been, because of the politicizing of the issue, the domestic terrorism around the issue where people have been harmed. There have been 11 people killed. 4 of them were doctors in the context of providing abortion care. That certainly has made what I call for non-democratic dissent against abortion, even though abortion remains legal through terrorism and exploitation of regulations. Those opposed to abortion have been able to punch again above their weight, if you will. And what I mean by that, if you look at the fact that the majority of people in this country, over 50% of people approve of abortion in some form or some fashion, the fact that we now have hundreds of local restrictions on abortion, even though abortion remains legal, has resulted in this hostile environment where people who could provide abortions don't. People who are now training in abortion care, many of them have been restricted in access to abortion education because a lot of medical education occurs at the hospital and clinical level in Catholic hospitals, which often have charters and mandates prohibiting access to abortion or training around abortion. So one of the things we've been trying to do is gain more control over the regulations of medical education to require people to train in abortion care. And so there are certainly the regulations that are shifting, but there's also the kind of consumer demand. And by that, I mean young people who are entering into medicine who are aware of the loss of access. They are actually seeking medical education that will provide them with the training to provide abortion. So organizations like Medical Students for Choice at the medical school level, women's studies and reproductive rights and reproductive justice or interest groups at the college level are informing people of abortion access challenges, and those people are aspiring to enter into medicine with the intent of becoming abortion providers. You have people who are pursuing education as non-physicians who are fighting for the right to be able to provide abortions, like nurse practitioners, midwives, and the like. So there's a consumer demand, but it's been thwarted in large part that even as abortion remains legal, the, again, domestic terrorism around people being harmed and injured, perpetually harassed and marginalized in their choice of a medical career, that is kind of cowering people away from providing the care. But I think that that's changing.
Now, what about the question, though, that also comes up a lot in relation to if women can't find somebody to actually give them an abortion, if they can't find a doctor or a clinic or something, or they can't afford it or whatever, they oftentimes turn to do-it-yourself abortions. And that seems to be a major plague in the world today, and directly a product of the kind of oppression that you're talking about coming down around women. Let's talk about that.
Well, actually, to your point, the majority of abortions that happen today in the world happen under unsafe circumstances, because the majority of them happen in places around the world, especially developing countries that have been controlled by people with fundamentalist religious understanding or very patriarchal ones. In those places, abortion is illegal, and in those places, that's where we see the greatest number of mortalities related to abortion. The mortalities come from the reality that I wish people simply understand that a woman or a person who's pregnant and they don't want to be, when they are resolved to not be pregnant, they will do whatever they need to do to end that pregnancy, such that a woman will choose illegal or unsafe abortion to end the pregnancy versus acquiescing to the reality of having a safe, legal pregnancy. So it's to say that women will do whatever they need to do. They will choose something that's potentially life-threatening if it's going to allow them to accomplish their reproductive goal, even when they could simply acquiesce and do something that would be safer. So women are committed to achieving their reproductive goals and not having their lives controlled by the interest of others. And so what that means is when we outlaw abortion, we don't make it less frequent. We make it less safe. The reality is that before Roe and after Roe, the number of abortions were approximately the same. What was different is the number of women who died from abortion. Deaths from abortions in this country became virtually nil from unsafe abortions. There's an intrinsic risk to every procedure, no matter how skilled the person is or no matter how optimal the circumstances are. People sometimes die. When you see a person goes in for a routine tonsillectomy and they don't wake up, there's an intrinsic risk with every procedure. But we know that when abortion is safe and is legal, that it is so safe that women rarely die from abortion. But yet when it's illegal and women are taking desperate measures, abortion becomes extremely risky. And the implications go beyond just a woman losing her life. Many women who have abortions are already parents, so that means children become orphans. Women have abortions are already partnered. That means that spouses or lovers lose a partner. And so there's an impact as a society. If those people were working, we lose people who can contribute. So there's losses on multiple levels when we lose sight of the fact that simply outlawing abortions doesn't make them less frequent. It only makes them less safe.
Now, you've argued that there is an analogy between putting limits on women's reproductive rights and slavery.
Yes. I know that sounds like bombast in a country that has a horrendous legacy of slavery and racism, and it sounds like bombast, especially when we live in a country that has that legacy but is unwilling to talk about race in a meaningful way. But all of us have some form of reference with slavery. Even the most sanitized notions of slavery, people understand that people were owned by other human beings and that those people's lives and wills and activities were controlled by the interests of other people. I can't think of a more apt or more direct analogy to denying a woman access to control over her body. So even for people who don't come from a legacy of slavery, in order to understand what it means when a woman cannot make her own reproductive health decisions, you simply need to understand that when captured Africans were under the control of people who economically used their labor for their own benefit and took away the self-determination of those people, that is no different from us reducing women to breeders when we say that they cannot control their reproduction and they are forced to continue pregnancies that they never wanted or that the ones that they wanted but that became dangerous for them to continue. I know that, again, perspective and proportion have to come into play, but if one understands the degree to which spoke with control, then one would see that there is a sense of proportionality to making that assertion.
Now, one of the things, and this is a fairly heavy thing because it actually plays out all the time, or it's in the background, actually more in the foreground these days, because something that people never really thought about very much, even though it's been going on for a while, and it's especially increased over the last couple of decades, is the danger to doctors who decide that they are, in fact, no matter what, they are going to provide abortions to women who need them. And there's been an occasional spurt here and there of doctors being killed, doctors and people that work in abortion clinics being killed. And it comes out now, even in terms of when places are surrounded, like you talk in your book about when you go to work every morning, you have to get out and you have to wonder in your own head what's going to happen between getting out of the car and getting to the door of the office of the abortion clinic. You know, and this whole idea that your life can be taken by someone who is so deeply opposed to the humanity of women that they're going to stop the one person that they think is actually ruining the lives of women, which is you, the doctor. And you said you have no desire to die prematurely, which, again, as I'm saying, is a real threat. But you're more intent on avoiding a death of spirit than avoiding harm for doing abortions. I thought that was something really important for people to consider and to hear your thoughts on.
You know, they say that you can't be brave unless you're scared. And I am like anybody else. I have value for life. And I know that sounds provocative to people who reduce life to an event by saying that life begins at conception and they fancy that a developing pregnancy is a person. But I am not any different from anybody else in that regard. Dr. King said that as well when he says, like anybody else, I want to live a long life. It has its place. But he says if a person has been found something that they live for to the point that in their pursuit of it, they might be injured fatally, that person's not fit to live. And he said, if you at 35 become afraid to do what you know is right in your heart, and you live another 65 years, when you finally start breathing, it's just a belated announcement of something that's already occurred. So I'm more, as you said, I decided that I can live with the fact that someone might try and harm me for doing what I know is the right thing. I don't know that I could live with myself if I had to face on a daily basis that I consciously became afraid to do what I knew was the right thing to do simply because someone threatened me. I have no desire to die prematurely, but the other way that I manage that risk and that possibility is to understand that we all have to choose what we live for and not pay so much attention to what we might die from, because we're all going to die. You know, I'm no more detached to being here. This is all I know. We can speculate about what's after, if there is an after, and that's what comes in the domain of our religious understanding. But when it comes to dealing with the reality every day, we all have to decide what counts. And Dr. King said that the most important question that you will have to ask yourself at the end of your life, or that someone may ask of you, is what did you do for others? It's not going to be whether or not you had a degree or how much money you had. It's what did you do for others? And to me, that's a very central principle for my life. In order for my life to have meaning and purpose and to count in the way that I want it to, I simply have decided that the way that I've chosen to serve women gives my life the meaning and the purpose that lets me get up every day and be fully aware that someone might be willing to harm me. But as long as I continue to focus on the rightness of what I do and who it helps, then I don't spend time worrying about how I might die.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Willie Parker, and we're talking about his life's work, and his book is called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Now, as I was going through your book and then thinking about this and reading some other things, I kept coming back to this point. On the one hand, you have all the assaults on the doctors and all the assaults on the right of women to have abortion that are out there in the public sphere, and they're all being pushed out, and you see it, you know, if you pay any attention to it, you see the hordes of anti-abortionists, people who are actually out there really trying to take women back to the Middle Ages or to keep women in their place and deny their humanity and all their rights as a human being. And you actually, at the same time, have had to confront not only those kinds of attacks, but you've also had to confront the reality that there's a tsunami of regulations that have been poured out to actually make it almost impossible for you to actually do the work in any kind of way where you can just walk in and do your work and know that you're doing good and deal with it. You have a whole pile of just this, you know, barrel of regulations that are hitting you from every day, from every angle. And I know you were in the movie Trapped, which was a very powerful movie, and it actually spoke to some of this, how this tsunami of regulations is really meant to, one, hit at the doctors, but also to sort of make it so that there's, to try and seal off the abortion clinics and the people willing to do abortions from the women who need them.
Yes, it's hyper-regulation. It's abuse of regulatory authority. Each state has a Department of Health, and that Department of Health is charged with protecting the health and well-being of its citizens. And it's interesting to me that ideologically, some people have chosen to grant citizenship to unborn pregnancies at the expense of the women carrying those pregnancies. And so while they've not been able to successfully overthrow the law of the land in terms of the Roe decision, although it feels to me like we're on a road to make that happen, in the absence of that, in the past 44 years, what they've done is functionally gutted the provisions of Roe. That the thing that stands between states carrying out their own agendas around reproductive rights, the thing that stands between that and women's access has been that Roe says that in the first trimester, nobody can outlaw abortion. But now you have states that say, okay, if we can't outlaw the abortion, we're going to make you wait as long as possible because we're going to create some notion that you, when you make your decision, you need more time to make it. We're not going to provide funding that would support poor women to have the same access to services that women of means would have. We're going to have regulations around how wide the halls can be or how many bathrooms are there, various ways in which you can create regulations that appear to have something to do with safety, but in no way at all do they have any bearing on the content of abortion care. So it's been an abuse of regulatory authority to, in essence, legitimize the idealized position of folk who are against abortion. You can't walk into a state house and say, the Lord told me that abortion is evil, so as a state, we shouldn't do it. But you can walk in and say that fetuses are babies, and we have a compelling interest in the state to protect the life of all of our citizens, and we have a compelling interest to protect the lives of the women, even though we know without a doubt, incontrovertibly via evidence and studies, that abortion is one of the safest, most common procedures, and there's no question that when women have access to safe abortion, their lives are protected and preserved. So some people say that when you live in a society, there can be an inverse correlation between the presence of justice and the number of laws. Or in other words, when you live in a just society, you don't need laws to make people conform to justice. A just society, people will willingly participate and abide by the rules of that society. So the injustice of denying women access to abortion is often perpetrated paradoxically by increasing laws that pretend to create justice when they do anything but.
You know, it's one of the things that actually happens around a lot of this is the attacks on abortion are often rooted in these what you've called wildly false concepts that are completely opposed by the actual truth of the matter. And following along with that is that getting an abortion, being pregnant and deciding that you want to get an abortion is the one condition that is treated like it's sort of a sacred thing, and women have to go through all kinds of hoops to try and even just decide to say, no, I want an abortion. It's my body. I want to actually get an abortion. I'm not going to deal with this. And they have to prove to authorities that they've actually thought carefully about abortion. Somebody who has cancer, gets a tumor, doesn't come in and decide that they've thought carefully about whether or not they should deal with it. They say, look, I want to get it treated. But with this, where you have this situation with women and they're being really sort of penned in and basically prevented, and there's attempts to prevent them from doing what they actually want to do and what's available and necessary if they want to do it. Again, going back to this thing of that these are rooted in wildly false concepts that are completely opposed by the actual truth.
Absolutely. I'm of the persuasion that the truth will do. And yet, because the truth doesn't favor their agenda, people who are opposed to abortion is going to deal with anything but the truth. You know, I thought about the irony. I was like, you know, if we regulated guns the way we regulated women's bodies, we'd have a much safer society. We trust people with guns more than we trust a woman with the decision about her body and what to do with a pregnancy. But to your point that you were making, I cringe and I marvel at the fact that no other aspect of medicine, given my belief that abortion is healthcare, is scrutinized, regulated, and targeted and has such targeted rules regarding it as abortion. Abortion is the only area that does that, and I think it's rooted in the fact that we simply refuse to trust women with the important decision of what to do with the process going on in their bodies. It is the ultimate disrespect, and it's the ultimate mark of patriarchal power and chauvinism to govern and to regulate a process so highly and so tightly that is exclusively the domain of a woman's health and her reproduction.
Let me ask you this. You said that the political conversation around abortion has obliterated the truth and crushed any nuanced understanding of what it means to live a human life. And I thought that was a pretty powerful statement to make. Let's talk about that. Explain to people what you mean by that.
Well, you know, I think life, as I said, I think in some ways, slogans and phrases and jingles are designed to undermine critical thinking. And so the fact that people have in a very ahistorical and very recent effort to gain political power, they've changed the notion of what, you know, the institution and the agency that has the most interest in describing why life is has made the understanding of what life is a moving target. You know, the church, in terms of when the church had to deal with the notion of reproduction, it says that ensoulment or life began when the soul entered into a body. So if one conceived and that body grew, as we know it does biologically in pregnancy, the understanding used to be that ensoulment or life didn't begin for until quickening or the first time that a woman could feel the fetus move, which has routinely been in early pregnancies, in first pregnancies at 20 weeks. And so according to that religious understanding, life began at that point, which is not the same as saying life begins at conception. So when I've tried to say that reproduction has scientific and biologic relevance, and for people who are trying to understand it and explain it, it has non-empiric or non-scientific value. And I think that those two things don't have to compete, but they often do because people who want to control power, and in this case, control the lives and the bodies of women, seek to control reproduction because reproduction plays out in the bodies of women. So when somebody is saying with regard to this whole conversation about the morality of abortion, and they offer their rationale that all life is sacred, life begins at conception, I say respectfully to that person, I respect your right and your ability to believe that, but when you say life begins at conception, you've given a non-scientific understanding of what life is. Life can't begin at conception when you have to have a live sperm and a live egg in order to have a live conception. So what that means is life has to begin before conception, and life is therefore a process and not an event. And then when I say that, I'm not belittling the fact that people, from a religious standpoint, can say life begins at conception and declare the intent of a greater power and a greater being. You know, I'm free to understand that in that way as well. But when it comes to controlling the bodies and the lives of women, the allowing people who have a certain religious understanding about reproduction that is not in any way linked to the scientific realities is to position ourselves as a society, as we've done, to deny women access to the very vital service of abortion, which is necessary for them to control their lives and to protect their health.
Now, you've gone on quite a journey in your life. You've started out after you trained as a doctor and you were starting out in your practice. You went from not providing abortions, and even though you would say that, you know, well, if a woman came up to you and told you she wanted an abortion, she needed one, you would, you know, suggest that they go to another doctor that would provide the abortion. But you've gone from that kind of a position to actually providing abortions, and each time there's been a sort of a big incident that happened that actually pushed you in a certain direction when you sat back and thought about it. And you've gone from not doing abortions to actually becoming one of the major abortion providers in the country and in a gathering of people, a group of people that actually has really, what, it's sort of shrunken by 50% or more in the last decade or so or more. And it's very heavy when you look at this, because you also now have ended up where this is not only your primary work, but you're a leading spokesperson around this in terms of fighting for people to recognize a woman's right to an abortion, but also the fact to recognize the woman's humanity. And I wanted to ask you this. Most recently, or I guess actually the most recent move you've made, involved something called My Sister's Keeper and a person named Susan Yanow. And I wanted you to tell people about that, because I thought that was a very, very important moment in your life when you decided to work with her.
Well, when I became aware of the access issues in the South, when I became an abortion provider, I was sympathetic and understood that, but my life course had me. I left the South when I was 18 years old, and growing up in the South and dealing with racism and the limitations that I found until I left, I liked having grown up in the South. I loved the people. I loved the region. But when I left as an 18-year-old, I thought the South was a better place to be from than to be in, and I had no immediate intentions to go back. But when I was asked to do a survey if I was willing to travel and was matched with the clinic in Mississippi as a place that had open services but had a limited number of providers, I went and visited and made my decision to go home. So it was the effort of Susan, who does work worldwide, to make sure that women have access to the often life-saving care that is abortion, that she was making an effort to make sure that doctors who were trained to provide abortion were identifying the areas where the need was, and that if at all possible, trying to prompt us to consider going to the place where the need is. That just resonated with me, and it kind of upstaged my path that I was on. I'd already made my decision to leave Hawaii to pursue abortion training. On the day that Dr. Tiller was assassinated, I had already made my decision to step more fully into abortion care by becoming the medical director of Planned Parenthood and to no longer provide advanced gynecologic care or obstetrics. But the crisis moment, it was, in Hawaii, when I made the decision to get the training, I was in a situation where I had to decide if I was going to stand up for what I knew was right. But the crisis moments for me have not been per se something that happened to a particular patient or something that happened to me. It's been an ongoing pursuit of what it means to live conscientiously and to be self-aware, and both also aware of what the world that I live in and where it's going and what my role is to make sure it goes in a direction that values the humanity of all of us as people. So if anything, it's always been a recognizing for me, what can I live with? And when I become aware of an injustice, particularly one that I have specific skills to address, it basically becomes a crisis of conscience. I often say that someone said that when you wrestle with your conscience and you lose, you actually win. And I lost that first battle 15 years ago in Hawaii. And, each subsequent decision, like going to full-time practice of abortion care with the understanding that many other people will do the other part, but there are men and women where nobody will help them, and I wanted to make myself available to the women that no one else would help. That decision, as well as the decision to go home to where the need was, even though that was hypothetically placing me more at risk.
And on top of that, and this will be the last question, but on top of that, there also seems to run through your entire book and actually through your life, this idea that particularly since you started doing abortions and offering abortions to women and fighting for that right, for women to have that right, you sort of have rooted yourself in the understanding that women actually are the agents of their own lives and futures. And that's a fairly important and very, very controversial concept in the world today.
It has to do with, you've taken me back to what's at root. It's easy to fathom, and I get a lot of people who want to give me credit for being a man doing this work. And that would, for me, I'm tempted to be flattered by that, that would root my work in a sense of chivalry. And I don't think chivalry has the moral compulsion to make one commit to abortion care. It really comes down to the way I see the world, and that's a one of fundamental fairness, where we are all human beings and our life options and chances should not stratify by the biology that we're born into. I think Abraham Lincoln, in offering one of the rationales for why he ended slavery, made a statement that I think best captures why I do abortion care. When someone asked him why he chose to free the slaves, he said that as I would not be a slave, so I will not be a master, which is to say that even though he probably did not see enslaved Africans who were newly freed as his social equal, he certainly, in order to make the notion to be pragmatic about saving the Union, he had to see them as his human equal. And I see that women are no different in their humanity than men are. And in fact, I see for men to participate in patriarchy and being willing to subordinate women, we have to, in some ways, be less human than women. And so I chose that I would not be more of a man than a human being, more black than human, more straight than human, or more Christian than human. And so if any of those identities compete with my humanity, I reject them. And so to be more of a man in a patriarchal sense would be to be indifferent to the fact that women need abortion care, and to refuse to stand in solidarity as they liberate themselves would mean that I would have to acquiesce to a manhood rooted in patriarchy, which, in my opinion, makes us less than human.
All right, Dr. Parker, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, we've just been talking with Dr. Willie Parker, and his book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And Dr. Parker is based in the South, and he travels all over the country, actually out there providing abortions and fighting for people to understand the importance of the right to women to have an abortion when they want or need one. All right, so we're going to take a quick break and be right back.
When I was 9 years old, I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I had saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room, playing with the toys. And I am here to exercise my freedom of choice.
Welcome back. That was Lost Woman Song from Annie DeFranco. All right, now we're going to be listening to a clip from the film BA Speaks Revolution Nothing Less, and it's Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, speaking on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution.
Now, earlier I spoke to the fact that the division of society into masters and slaves, into different classes, developed together with the oppression of women. These were very tightly bound together in their historical development and have remained so throughout the course of history since that time through different kinds of societies. And today we can see the ways in which the oppression of women, not just in a particular country, but on a world scale, continues to feed the functioning of this capitalist imperialist system. Not only, as I pointed out, is it highly profitable in the billions and billions of dollars to oppress women in sex trafficking, prostitution, and pornography, but also the backward conditions that are maintained and enforced by the functioning and the military power of the imperialist countries throughout the Third World lead to a situation where many women are outcast and desperate and highly vulnerable to being exploited in this vast network of sweatshops that is at the foundation of imperialist capital in the world today. You know, I think of the phenomenon of people standing in line for the latest gadget from Apple. And I have to say, it makes me mad. I say to myself, what the f*** is the matter with you people? You can stand in line overnight for the latest gadget from Apple, but you can't stand up to oppose wars and torture and mass incarceration and the degradation of women. What the hell is the matter with you people? Now, to be clear, those people standing in line are not the enemy. But what is represented by Apple, and not just Apple unto itself, but the whole system and the network of exploitation that Apple is a part of and enmeshed in, is what needs to be swept aside. I mean, when you're at the end of the food chain in a country like this, living parasitically, even if you're not in the ruling class, off of people all over the world, once again, sometimes all this can be hidden from you. You do not see the blood and the bones, the worn down fingers and other body parts of particularly women who are working in the plants in places like China, making the components that go into the Apple products and all these other things under horrific conditions. You do not see the people in Bangladesh making many of the clothes that you're wearing. And when you leave here and go home tonight, look in your closet and see how many of your clothes you can find are not made in the Third World, and you can be sure if they are made in places like Bangladesh, Haiti, Pakistan, or whatever, that they're made through a lot of child labor and, in any case, extreme conditions of sweatshop exploitation. But we do not, the products don't come with this stamped on them. You don't pick up an iPhone, press a button, and the blood of the women who made it comes gushing out. But it's there, even though you can't see it. And imperialism feasts on this. Don't let them fool you with their talk about microloans. Let's have some microloans for poor women in the third world so they can set up a business and exploit other women and then, in their large numbers, fail anyway. This is not what the imperialist system is doing. This is a tiny countercurrent to the massive exploitation on which of these very kinds of women on which this system rests. And look at this country. Not only is there the great value to imperialist capital of super exploitation of women in the third world, but in this country it's a fact that the social relations that oppress women are critical for holding together this whole oppressive system, which has historically evolved with male domination, a key foundation of the whole system, a foundation stone built into its whole structure. Think about the family and how people live and reproduce in this society. Everything in this society is based on commodity production and exchange. You don't have little groups of people all making overwhelmingly the things they need and then using them themselves. There's vast networks of exploitation in this country, but increasingly in other parts of the world, producing all these things. And then you have to get some means by working in some way or other to have the basis of to have the commodity money to go buy these things. That's the way the economy works. And all of it gets funneled through the what these reactionaries are always reminding us is the basic unit and cell of this society, the family. And the whole family has evolved historically with women being subordinate to men and having as one part of that the prime responsibility for the domestic aspect of things, including the rearing of children and things like just doing the everyday work of the house. And there have been some changes in this society. More women in the professions, more women going to college, more women working in a lot of ways. And all this has put tremendous strains on these oppressive relations, but it hasn't broken them because this system cannot do without these relations. And so you have this tremendous potential eruption where the changes in the economy are straining against the limitations of the oppression of women and other exploitative and oppressive relations, but the system cannot do without them. Now, as one illustration of this, I was reading an article in the New York Times about a phenomenon in the South where some of these men who had fairly good paying industrial jobs, once again the phenomenon, the companies closed down, move the factories away, the men are out of work, the women are going out and getting the jobs and service and whatever that are available to them that they can get, but the men are largely sitting on their couches, drinking their beer and moping. And one of the authors of this article asked one of these men, well, why don't you go out and get one of these jobs that these women are doing? He said, no, I can't do that. It's not man's work. I just wouldn't feel like a man if I had a job like that. This captures a lot about the contradictions of this system and how it's intensifying. And in reading this, I was thinking about what Engels wrote in The Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State, and talking about the Roman Empire, Engels, who along with Marx founded the communist movement. He was talking about agriculture in the declining period of the Roman Empire, that it had been based on slave plantations called latifundia. But as the Roman Empire went into decline, the plantations, the slave plantations, the latifundia became less and less profitable. And so they broke down and people had to go back into small-scale farming. But all of the former slave owners, or almost all of them, wouldn't go back and do actual farm work, even though the plantations were no longer profitable, because they considered it beneath their dignity to do that kind of work. And Engels pointed out, this contributed to the decline and weakening of Rome and made it more and more vulnerable to the barbarians that were increasingly at the gate and battering at the gate. And I was thinking about these men saying, I can't do that. It's not man's work. It doesn't make me feel like a man. How this represents a straining of the changes have brought about, straining against the oppressive relations. And I was thinking about how, in parallel to Rome, how this could also contribute to the further declining and weakening of this oppressive system and make it more vulnerable to the barbarians, namely us. Now, the oppression of women and all the horrors bound up with it can be ended, and something radically different and emancipating brought into being. Now, let's be honest. To many, especially many women, this may not seem possible, and frankly, hard to believe. But that is not only because of the way things are now, and the way so many men act so much of the time, but more fundamentally, because of the way things are now, sets a certain framework and tone for people's thinking. Because the possibility of radical change cannot be seen to the degree that our vision and our sense of reality and of possibility is still confined within, conditioned by, and filtered through the dominating relations that are at the foundation of this whole system. And the traditions, values, ways of being and of thinking that constantly pour forth from and serve to perpetuate this system that we are forced to live under. In this way, they get us twice. Their system embodies and enforces all this horrific oppression, and it has people believing that this cannot be done away with. But the truth, which they try every way to keep people from seeing, is that we can be rid of this horrific oppression. But we can't do this by accepting the terms of this system or any part of its oppression. We can't do it half-stepping and halfway. That is why Basics 322 makes it very clear. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity yet keep one half of humanity enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. And as this statement is also emphasizing, the fight against the oppression of women and for all the way revolution is not just their fight. It is a fight that must be fully and vigorously taken up by men as well, by everyone who really wants to see an end to this system and all the horrors it means for the masses of humanity. Everyone who wants to see an end to the long night in which humanity has been divided into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, who wants to see a dawning of a new day for humanity. The only people who should fear and not join in with this unleashed fury of women are those who have a real stake in this system and want to keep it going with everything it does to people.
That was Bob Avakian, or BA, on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. This is taken from his film, which is available on a DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. To find out more about BA, go to revcom.us and click on the Bob Avakian section. That was Bob Avakian, or BA, on the oppression of women bound up with this system, a driving force for revolution. This is taking from his film, which is available on a DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. To find out more about BA, go to revcom.us and click on the Babavakian section. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Willie Parker and Babavakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And for the names of any works, books, movies, DVDs, whatever that I mentioned on this show, go to my Facebook page. And that's where you're going to find the exact name of the piece that I played and a link to find out more about it. I want to thank the people involved in the show this week, my assistant producer Henry Carson, production assistant Jeff Pryor, and engineer Kiana Williams. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a song that I think needs to be played over and over and over again because it's just that important given the times we're in. It's called Decision by Outer National. Check this out and play it again and again. Talk to you again next week.
Like this.